A guilty plea from a former Trump administration official in the Russia probe.
General Flynn is one more example of the extent of ties between senior officials involved in the Trump efforts and the Russians.
A tempest from a tweet storm. President Trump's retweets spark international upset.
I'm very clear that retweeting from Britain First was the wrong thing to do.
And could a government shutdown steal Christmas in this town?
3, 2, 1.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. I'm Rachel Sutherland from Washington. Everyone in Washington just knew the big story this week would be tax reform, and it was most of the week. At the time we wrapped this broadcast, Republicans said they had the votes and the tax bill was poised for narrow passage. But then the bombshell news at the end of the week that the Russia probe had moved into President Trump's inner circle, as former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pleaded guilty to a single count of lying to the FBI. The news wasn't completely out of left field, though, as Flynn's lawyers had stopped communicating with the White House before Thanksgiving, a signal he was cooperating with special counsel Robert Mueller. And then he arrived at the courthouse. Fox News chief intelligence correspondent Catherine Herridge was at the D.C. courthouse when Flynn entered his plea.
Based on the records that were released, we can see how much communication there was between the presidential transition team, Flynn, and the Russian ambassador. And the special counsel concluded that Flynn had deliberately misled them about those conversations and the nature of those conversations. And significantly, this was not a fact that was disputed by Flynn in court as he entered that guilty plea.
Some of the communications included discussions between Flynn and Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the transition, including a request for Russia to moderate its response to the Obama administration's decision to kick Russian diplomats out of the U.S. It was sanctions for interfering in the presidential election. The next day, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced Moscow would not retaliate. And then President Trump tweeted about Putin, "I always knew he was very smart." We turned to the Wayback Machine and found an interview between Fox's Chris Wallace and Vice President Mike Pence discussing this very scenario. Listen to this exchange from last January.
Did Mike Flynn ever discuss lifting sanctions in any of those conversations? Do you know?
I talked to General Flynn yesterday, and the conversations that took place at that time were not in any way related to new U.S. sanctions against Russia or the expulsion of diplomats.
All right. Second question. Can you flatly deny, because this continues to be out there, that there were any contacts at any point during the campaign between Mr. Trump's associates and Russian operatives, including cutouts, as we know, about the hacking of the Democrats during the election?
Well, this, you know, some of this derives from this opposition research memo, I guess, Chris, that made its way around the internet. I remember there was about 24 hours where Michael Cohen, who has worked in the Trump organization for many years, was accused of having a meeting in Prague, and finally some news organization did a little checking and found out that it was a different Michael Cohen, and Michael himself had never actually been to Prague.
But I do want to ask
was
you a question.
Was at a baseball game with his son in August of last year.
I understand that, but there's been other talk, but in fact, if I may, the senators specifically asked FBI Director Comey about that, and he refused to answer. So I'm asking you a direct question. Was there any contact in any way between Trump or his associates and the Kremlin or cutouts they had?
I joined this campaign in the summer, and I can tell you that all the contact by the Trump campaign and associates was with the American people. We were fully engaged with taking his message to make America great again all across this country.
But have you ever asked Mr. Trump whether there were any contacts, sir? I'm just trying to get an answer.
Yeah, of course not. Why would there be any contacts between the campaign? Chris, this is all a distraction, and it's all a part of a narrative to delegitimize the election and to question the legitimacy of this presidency. Oh. The American people see right through it.
The conversations that Flynn is in trouble for lying about happened during the transition period. The Obama administration has argued there can only be one administration at a time. Adam Schiff, ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, reacted to the news.
These are very serious charges. This involves the National Security Advisor of the country lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russians on two serious subjects. And unfortunately, it's part of a broader pattern of people in the administration and in the campaign lying about their contacts with the Russians. But if this is the universe of charges that Mike Flynn is pleading guilty to, given the far broader exposure that he had on a variety of other matters, it tells me that he's providing substantial cooperation to Bob Mueller.
Republican Representative Marsha Blackburn had this to say.
I think that this is an important step. It is good that General Flynn is coming forward. He will deliver his plea, enter that plea, and then we will see what happens from there.
By late Friday, there was no official reaction from President Trump, but his lawyer said in a statement that false statements mirror those given to administration officials, which resulted in Flynn's resignation, and that nothing about the guilty plea or the charge implicates anyone but Flynn.
The tweets and retweets of President Trump regularly get a lot of attention in the U.S., but this week a trio of retweets from the president's handle sparked an international incident and stern backlash from the prime minister of a very close ally, Great Britain.
The fact that we work together does not mean that we're afraid to say when we think the United States have got it wrong and to be very clear with them, and I'm very clear that retweeting from Britain First was the wrong thing to do.
If you missed it, here's the quick background. Wednesday morning, the president retweeted three videos from Jada Franson, each purporting to show acts of violence from Muslims and refugees. One of those videos has been debunked by Dutch police as not involving a refugee. Franson is the leader of a group called Britain First, a controversial right-wing organization, a hate group, some call it. To shed some insight on Britain First and why these retweets are seen as so incendiary by UK leaders, I spoke with our London correspondent, Simon Owen. Simon, let's start with why the British government at its highest levels now are so upset, so disturbed, feel the need to weigh in on these retweets by President Trump earlier this week.
Yeah, I think they're angry and frustrated by what's happened, which is that President Trump retweeted three videos that had been posted on the Twitter page of a far-right leader here in Britain, a woman called Jada Franson. She fronts a group called Britain First, which is, it calls itself a political party, although it doesn't have any members in positions of public office. But it does have a significant social media following. And what it does a lot of the time is it posts these videos purporting to show Muslims committing crimes or doing other incendiary actions. Jada Franson herself was found guilty last year of a hate crime after shouting abuse at a Muslim woman wearing a hijab. And she is due to go on trial shortly on four similar charges she denies. She's not necessarily a particularly well-known figure here in Britain, but she is known in the political circles, and she attracted a lot of attention yesterday when President Trump broadcast her messages. She has something like 50,000 Twitter followers. The president, I think, is on about 44 million. So these videos went to a much wider audience. But it led to the British government being put in a position, really. I think it had a choice. Did it play this down in the hope of keeping relations as friendly as possible, or did it speak out? And there was quite a lot of opposition calling for Prime Minister Theresa May to respond firmly to this, and in the end her spokesman came out yesterday and said that it was wrong for the president to retweet these videos.
The ambassador from the United Kingdom to the United States, the British ambassador, also put out a statement. The British people overwhelmingly reject the prejudiced rhetoric of their far right, which seek to divide communities and erode decency, tolerance, and respect. British Muslims are peaceful and law-abiding citizens, and I raised these concerns with the White House yesterday. So the ambassador, the British ambassador here in Washington, says that he raised concerns directly to the White House. President Trump responded on Twitter, directing a tweet to Theresa May, the prime minister, and said, "Don't focus on me, focus on the destructive radical Islamic terrorism that is taking place within the United Kingdom. We are doing just fine." Has the Prime Minister first responded directly to that tweet from President Trump? And secondly, what is your sense of where this special relationship, as it's always described, between our two great countries is at right now?
Well, I think it's in extraordinary times, and I think this is potentially an unprecedented dispute in modern times between Britain and the US. President Trump's rebuke to Theresa May was sharp, and Theresa May's initial criticism was pretty robust as well. You know, this phrase, it was wrong to do that. Theresa May's response after receiving that tweet from President Trump, she says she's not a big tweeter herself, but she said that Britain and America's relationship is long-term and enduring, but that doesn't mean we're afraid to speak up. And she reiterated the initial comment. She said retweeting from Britain First was the wrong thing to do. And Britain First is the group that Jade Franson fronts. As for the status of the relationship, there has been cross-party condemnation of the president's retweeting, and it's unusual to get the various political parties here on the same page on any subject, but they are on this occasion pretty much. One of Theresa May's most senior ministers, a man called Sajid Javid, is a Muslim himself, and he said that the president, quote, has endorsed the views of a vile, hate-filled, racist organization that hates me and people like me. He is wrong, and I refuse to let it go and say nothing. One of the opposition leaders here, Vince Cable, said President Trump is an evil racist. And an opposition lawmaker, Stephen Doughty, said that by sharing these videos, President Trump is either a racist, incompetent, or unthinking, or all three. So it's pretty extraordinary language from British lawmakers to the leader of Britain's closest ally. But as to the bigger picture, you know, a lot of talk about what the Prime Minister calls the long-term and enduring relationship with the US. I think that is their way of saying that this does not mean that there's going to be any great breakdown here as far as they're concerned. One of her ministers said today, perhaps with a little less subtlety, she said on the radio, our relationship with the US has a longevity to it that will succeed long after presidents come and go, which perhaps suggests that, you know, they're looking at this in the bigger picture. Britain and America, key partners on all sorts of issues, but particularly security, work very closely. And I think that the general feeling at the top of the British government is that they don't plan to let this derail it. Britain at the moment is pretty short on friends in Europe with the whole exiting the EU process going on. So Theresa May has gone out of her way to be friends with President Trump. A number of opposition lawmakers here are saying that after this latest incident, this is not the first time President Trump has criticized Britain's response to terrorism and so on. A lot of opposition lawmakers have been saying it's time to rescind an invitation for the president to make a state visit to the UK. Well, the government is saying that plans for that visit remain on the table. There's no date or anything like that.
Right.
But they're not saying they're not rescinding that invitation or anything like that.
This is a state dinner that has been sort of long talked about, but has yet to be formalized, right?
Yes. And it was an invitation that was issued very early on in the president's time in office. I think Theresa May was the first foreign leader to visit the Trump White House. And she issued this invitation, come for a state visit. And that all plays into the Brexit situation and Theresa May needing allies on the world stage because, as I say, Britain not particularly popular in the rest of Europe at the moment.
Simon Owen, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Jared.
Now for the latest installment of Bureaucrats Behaving Badly. Allegedly, in this case, we go to Michigan, where embattled Congressman John Conyers has been in the hospital for stress-related symptoms. The 88-year-old checked himself in after sexual harassment accusations hit the news, while the entire Democratic caucus called on him to resign. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
The brave women who came forward are owed justice. I pray for Congressman Conyers and his family and wish them well. However, Congressman Conyers should resign.
Conyers is facing a wave of public accusations that he sexually harassed women while in Congress, accusations he denies. On Friday, Conyers' attorney, Arnold Reed, said doctors are giving him another round of tests, and he's not going anywhere.
We will discuss in the next day or so what Mr. Conyers plans to do. As you know, his health is not the best. It is not what it should be. He has undergone a second round of examinations. I will meet and confer with doctors, and it will be Congressman John Conyers who will be the one to decide what it is he is going to do in terms of whether he's going to continue to represent the people. It's not going to be Washington, but we will meet in the next couple days, if he gets stronger, which I anticipate he will, so that we can discuss these issues. The people need to know this, and he is the individual that has fought for the people in this community for a number of years, and we will talk very shortly. Now, the other, no questions right now, sir, thank you. The other thing that you need to know, and we just pulled this down, another lawmaker, $84,000 settlement. I haven't heard as much as a peep from Washington as to whether this person should step down. Not even as much as a peep. So all that we're saying here is we're going to ensure that this is a fair process. We're going to ensure that Congressman Conyers makes a decision that is not rushed, that is not hurried, and that due process will be paramount of that process if it involves him testifying or whatever. He's going to get due process. So again, we will make another announcement in the coming days as to whether the congressman will continue or whether he will step aside. But that decision is not being made today and most likely will not be made tomorrow.
BuzzFeed News reported last week Conyers settled a complaint 2 years ago for $27,000 with a female staffer who claimed she was fired because she rejected his advances. And Marion Brown, a former aide, broke a confidentiality agreement to publicly allege he propositioned her for sex multiple times over the course of more than a decade. A former scheduler filed a complaint earlier this year but later dropped it. Another former staffer, Deanna Marr, said Conyers undressed to his underwear in front of her. Elected to office in 1965, Conyers is the longest continuously serving member of the House and a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus. Conyers was the one who pushed to establish the Martin Luther King Jr. Day federal holiday, introducing the law just a few days after his civil rights leader's death. He was also behind the Violence Against Women Act and Motor Vehicle Bill. Conyers has stepped away from the House Judiciary Committee after the sexual harassment allegations came to light. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Al Franken, accused of inappropriate behavior with several women, returned to work this week with no plans to step down. But Republican Congressman Joe Barton of Texas announced he will not seek re-election next year after an explicit photo connected to an extramarital affair was revealed online.
Every time you dial your cell phone, there is a record made, not only of the number you dialed, but a location identified by a cell tower. Those records of each call is kept by your service provider. How police get access to that information is now a question the justices on the Supreme Court are answering. They listened to nearly an hour and a half of arguments about that topic this week. The case stems from the arrest and conviction of Timothy Carpenter, who was suspected of leading a ring of electronics store robbery several years ago. Prosecutors used 127 days worth of cell tower records to place Carpenter near those robbery scenes. Police did get a court order, but relied on legislation, the Stored Communications Act, that does not require the same level of scrutiny as a warrant that you would need to, say, search your home or track your movements. The government's attorney, Deputy Solicitor General Michael Dreeben, opened his argument suggesting the technology that we're talking about with cell phone towers may be new, but the legal principles are not.
The cell phone companies in this case function essentially as witnesses being asked to produce business records of their own transactions with customers. The cell systems cannot function without information about where the phones are located. Anyone who subscribes to a cell phone service will communicate that information to towers in order to receive calls. The cell phone companies get that information to operate the cell network. They choose to make their own business records of that information. It's not a government mandate. They make decisions based on their own business needs about what they're going to retain. And when the government comes and asks them to produce it, it is doing the same thing that it did in Smith. It is doing the same thing that it did in Miller. It is asking a business to provide information about the business's own transactions with a customer. And under the third-party doctrine, that does not implicate the Fourth Amendment rights of the customer.
In other words, that record, he says, isn't your record. It's the cell phone company's business record and does not carry Fourth Amendment protections against search and seizure. That argument got a lot of pushback, including from Justice Neil Gorsuch, who asked why cell phone users don't have a property right to data about their locations.
Wouldn't that therefore be a search of my paper or effect under the property-based approach approved and reminded us of in Jones?
I suppose that if you are insisting that I acknowledge that it's a property right, some consequences are going to follow from
right.
that.
Okay.
I don't think you can
Let's stick with my hypothetical, counsel, okay? I know you don't like it. I got that. But let's say that, in fact, I've got positive law that indicates it is a property right. Would you therefore agree that that's a search of my paper in effect?
Dreeben didn't concede the point, but he did get some help with a counterpoint from Justice Samuel Alito.
Yeah, Mr. Dreeben, and I think along those lines, I was trying to think of an example of a situation in which a person would have a property right in information that the person doesn't ask a third party to create. The person can't force the third party to create it or to gather it. The person can't prevent the company from gathering it. The person can't force the company to destroy it. The person can't prevent the company from destroying it. And according to petitioner, the customer doesn't even have a right to get the information.
The challenge, of course, is trying to give guidance when technology advances much faster than the United States appellate system. Justice Anthony Kennedy and Carpenter's attorney Nathan Wessler talked about that.
In an area where we're searching for a compromise, where it's difficult to draw a line, why shouldn't we give very significant weight to the Congress's determination that there should be and will be some judicial supervision over this, investigations.
Justice Kennedy, Congress enacted the Stored Communications Act in 1986 and amended it in relevant part in 1994. 0.3% of Americans had cell phones in 1986, only 9% in 1994. There were about 18,000 cell towers in 1994. Today, there are over 300,000.
You mean the act was more necessary when there were fewer cell phones?
No, not
they
not
just the opposite.
Justices also considered the role broad searches like these cell tower locations can serve to quickly narrow down a field of suspects well before an arrest is made. An opinion could be delivered in a matter of weeks or months. The court's term ends in June.
In a Washington tradition that began with President Calvin Coolidge, President Trump and the First Lady took part in the lighting of the national Christmas tree this week.
3, 2, 1.
The president reflected on the meaning of the season.
Christmas is a time for prayer and worship, for gratitude and goodwill, for peace and renewal.
The ceremony was hosted by Kathy Lee Gifford and Dean Cain and included musical acts from the Beach Boys and the U.S. Navy Band. The Colorado blue spruce is lit for now on the Ellipse, but there's an outside chance it could go dark. If Congress fails to fund the government in time, watch out for a shutdown showdown next week. Also, look for Supreme Court arguments that could determine whether bakeries can be forced to provide cakes for same-sex weddings, as well as all the latest on Michael Flynn and the Russia probe. That will do it for this week's From Washington podcast. If you enjoy this From Washington podcast, then you'll love the Fox News Rundown, our new daily podcast, analysis, and insight on the day's biggest stories straight to your phone every morning. You can subscribe to all of our Fox News Radio podcasts on Apple or wherever you search for new audio content. And as always, stay up on the very latest with your Fox News Radio affiliate and our social media pages on Twitter and Facebook. For all of us here at Fox News Radio, I'm Rachel Sutherland from Washington.